In 1861, just as the Civil War began, the leaders of the Confederacy soon realized that they were completely outmatched when it came to naval power. They only had one commissioned ship versus the Union's 42. They realized that the only way to outfit a strong navy was to receive support from abroad, specifically from Great Britain, which, although neutral at the time, leaned toward the Confederacy due to the extremely lucrative cotton trade. Southern leaders dispatched the charming and devious Captain James Bullock to Liverpool to lead the way to secretly acquire a cutting-edge fleet of ships and weapons that would break Lincoln's blockade of Confederate port cities. This whole scheme would be funded by the profits from gunrunning and smuggling cotton. He was opposed by the American consul, Thomas Dudley, a Quaker and an abolitionist, and in one sense, the absolute worst man for the job. He was extremely moral and hated involving himself in Liverpool, the city where the spy games took place, which was something out of the nightmare of Charles Dickens, one of the most densely populated, crime-ridden, and corrupt cities on planet Earth at the time. But if Dudley failed to stop Bullock, Britain would likely ally with the South and imperil a northern victory. To tell the story is today's guest, Alexander Rose, author of The Lion and the Fox, Two Rival Spies and the Secret Plot to Build a Confederate Navy. Hope you enjoyed this discussion about Civil War-era spycraft and espionage. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. You've written on espionage in the Revolutionary War, and we're now moving to the Civil War era, where the craft has had 8 decades to evolve. Now, in some aspects, espionage is timeless, and the tactics are similar from ancient Greece to the modern era. But in other senses, it has changed. People have had the benefit to learn. States are more advanced now. There are new technologies. Is there anything that you could pinpoint that has changed from the 1770s when we looked at revolutionary era spycraft to the 1860s?
What's changed quite a lot is the, well, among other things, ciphers are better. You know, the code making, code breaking, they're much more advanced than they were during the revolution. In Washington Spies, I talk about coding. And in the 18th century, it was just a very simple substitution code. So you would use, you know, I don't know, 1, 2, 3 for the word regiment, something like that. It was just a basic bit of substitution. By the Civil War, you have something called the Visionaire Code and various other much more complex cipher systems. So yes, there's been several advances like that. The problem is that, you know, with every advance in ciphering, you have additional problems in deciphering and getting your message securely through. It's not really the message that gets you, it's the transmission of that message back to headquarters that catches you out. So the weird thing is that they had, the Civil War people did have much more advanced ciphers. The problem is that they didn't really use them, or they tried to use them, but they were just such a pain in the neck. They eventually just gave up and wrote in plain English and just kind of alluded vaguely to things. You know, instead of such an ironclad, they would regard it, they would talk about, you know, that thing you ordered, you know, that sort of thing. There's a code between individuals. So that's the interesting thing, is that they have all this rather more advanced technology available. They just go back to old ways, essentially. Because one of the reasons being is that, unlike in the Civil War, where, say, the Culpa Ring, which were on Long Island near New York, you know, they had to get their messages to Washington's headquarters, which was, let's just say, an average, you know, about 50 or 60 miles away in Connecticut or in the Hudson Valley. It's a long distance, but it can be traversed by a horse in a day or two. Whereas in the Civil War, you have, you know, the distances are just simply much longer. And you can make that exponentially more difficult if you're trying to transmit, as these spies were doing during the book focuses on, from Britain over to the United States or the Confederate States, for that matter. You know, it's, what is it, 2,500, 3,000 miles of open sea that you have to, there's no undersea cables, there's nothing like that. So it just takes at least, you know, 2 or 3 weeks really to get anything through. So you might as well just speak in regular language to make it easier. But in terms of structure, a little bit has changed. I mean, you have the formation of much more centralized, more efficient states over the course of the 19th century, by the 1860s. You know, these are highly administrative, bureaucratic states. They have departments and they have bureaus and they have, you know, they have ministries and all this kind of stuff. But you don't see a lot of that with the intelligence business. there are stumblings towards it. But a prime mistake that people often make is assuming that there was some kind of precursor to the CIA or something like that back at the time. And it really wasn't. There really wasn't. It was mostly individuals working ad hoc or working on a personal basis. For instance, Bullock, the Confederate agent in the book, you know, he reports to only one person. He's a kind of a one-man dog. He reports to Mallory, the Secretary of the Navy in Richmond. But because of the difficulties in transmissions, he's essentially left to work alone on his own steam for much of the war and occasionally just report back about what he's doing. So yes, the spy stuff has not really advanced as much as you probably might have expected over the intervening near century.
It sounds like spycraft in the Civil War era is sort of like military strategy in the World War I era, where technology has advanced, but the tactics haven't caught up yet to take advantage of all this. And we would like to imagine a steampunk scenario where there are secret agents using all these gadgets and taking advantage of telegraph lines. And you can see this sprinkled out in all sorts of movies like the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes, where Moriarty is using the cutting edge wireless technology to do this type of late 19th century terrorism. But sadly, it's not as flashy as all that, from what I gather.
There's no one's pistols coming, like shooting out of people's sleeves and things like that. There's none of that. I mean, but they did use the telegraph wire, but that was within the country, within Britain itself, for instance, or in the United States, they did the same thing. What that does is it just makes transmissions of messages and information faster. But the problem with every technology like that, as they discovered during the Civil War, is that it can also be tapped. There's always a counter defense to the offense. Yeah, so in the book, you know, they, you know, it's used occasionally, the telegraph, to transmit a message to so that the Bullock can kind of get an early tip off. So it does make a difference. It's just not a colossal difference when you have within Britain and the mail there is extremely efficient. I mean, you can get much more efficient than nowadays. You can get things up and down the country in less than a day. Yeah, so it is interesting. But yeah, there's no great steampunk weaponry going on there. Nobody had access to that, unfortunately.
If listeners want to see this idea that we're discussing here taken to its most ridiculous extreme, they can watch the Will Smith movie Wild Wild West. This is the only context in which I could ever possibly recommend that movie. And if you are unfortunate enough to watch it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But getting to the topic of your book, the plot revolves around attempts by the Confederacy to build up a navy. Could you describe why this was so important for the Confederacy's war aims?
Well, the Navy, though, the naval war during the Civil War, I think, and I'm being kind of speaking broadly here, has always been the sort of the ugly sister or the kind of Cinderella to the land war. I mean, much more attention is always paid to Lee and Grant and McClellan and Lincoln and so on. But the naval war was just as important, or in some cases, much more important for international and diplomatic reasons. The British and the French, for instance, who were the real world superpowers at the time, especially the British, didn't really understand the land war that well. What they did understand was naval power and the command of the ocean and the trade routes and so forth, and its effect on, although any kind of one of Lincoln's blockades, its effect on their titanic economies. Whereas, you know, a battle going this way or that in Virginia, you know, was interesting, but not particularly important to them. So what I wanted to focus on in the book was this War of the Seas. And so my own view is that it was just as important as the land war. And so what you have is that it's what happens in Britain. The Confederacy realized very early on, within days of the war breaking out, that their survival, ultimately, aside from a very fast kind of blitzkrieg against the Union Army, relied on trying to acquire international support, most especially from the British. If they could lure or pressure or leverage the British into backing the South, either with weaponry or even better still, recognizing the South as an independent state, which then, you know, that would kind of crush the Union. So for the entirety of the war, there was this kind of Anglo-Confederate dream of this union between these two great nations that would allow the Royal Navy to come in and come in swinging at the Union Navy, which would have been probably destroyed in any kind of major naval battle. So that was the original intention of the Confederates here. And, you know, it wasn't a foolish idea. Within Britain, there was a very powerful pro-Confederate community, very powerful, very influential. I mean, most MPs in the Parliament, many of the peers in the House of Lords, newspaper proprietors, industrialists, and so on, you know, were very pro-Confederate. Not because they were, you know, particularly in favor of slavery. I don't think it's very difficult to find anyone in Britain arguing in favor of slavery. They weren't really that crass. It was that the South is so important for its cotton. And the cotton, Britain runs on Southern cotton, essentially. That it's called, you know, Dixie's white gold. You know, something like 20% of the population of Britain at that time was reliant directly or indirectly on cotton and its imports in its raw form from the South and coming into Liverpool and being, you know, upgraded into clothing and textiles and so on, and then being re-imported to the empire overseas or into other trading partners. So the British were very concerned about maintaining that cotton line across the Atlantic. And what they all they could see was that Lincoln was interfering with this and, you know, setting up his blockade of ships essentially to stop British trading vessels, you know, entering southern ports. So that automatically annoys them. So that the South, you know, to go back to the point, we're not fools in thinking this. They could have come very, very close, or they did come very, very close to bringing Britain in on their side. And so when Bullock, the Confederate agent, goes to Britain in early 1861, you know, the world is his oyster there. I mean, he goes to Liverpool, which was the mightiest city port in the world. I mean, it built more ships in Liverpool than the rest of the world combined. That's how powerful a mercantile center this was. And his job is to just buy, acquire, commission, basically a Confederate Navy, starting off with a fleet of blockade runners. So you can import cotton and guns and weaponry and necessities and luxuries and so on into and out of the South to raise money and keep the war effort going. And it's after that, you know, to move on to the commerce raiders that would later become the CSS Alabama and the Florida. And finally, in sort of phase three, to build some of the world's most advanced ironclads, which were later known as the Laird Rams. Laird's was the great shipyard that they were commissioned from. And these things were basically to go out there and literally ram the U.S. Navy and sink them at sea and drown them at sea. So it was a very well thought out plan. And when Bullock goes over, he thinks, well, this will be easy. You know, I'll be here for, you know, a year and then I'll just go back home. The problem is that as he's traveling on the ship over, the British unexpectedly decide to declare neutrality, that they are going to, that they're just going to stay out of this whole war, which they don't really understand. It's another one of, I think I put it in the book, it's one of their sort of rancorous colonial cousins' inexplicable fights. They don't really understand it. And I think Russell, the foreign secretary, says, for God's sake, let's just stay out of this. So they want to wait. The British want to wait until a clear winner emerges. And then you obviously side with that guy. And the same with the French, for that matter. So what, and then also the blockade is imposed by Lincoln and so on. So on the way over, Bullock's mission becomes incredibly complex. He's suddenly not in quite as friendly a country as he thought he was. He's in a very friendly city. Liverpool was incredibly pro-Confederate. I think Bullock writes that when he gets over there, he's surprised because he just sees more Confederate flags and bunting in downtown Liverpool than he could even see in Richmond, which is really saying something. So what happens is that Bullock now has a major challenge ahead of him. He's got to get around and evade British neutrality laws, which is a tricky thing to do. But he finds a way. He finds a loophole in this very old legislation that nobody had ever tested before. And he finds a hole that you could quite literally, or almost literally, I guess, sail a fleet through. And that's what he does. And in the Union, in response, sends its own man there. And his job is to stop Bullock by any means necessary.
Backing up a bit, can you tell me about Captain James Bullock and who he is, why the Confederacy dispatched him to Liverpool, and how they hoped he would go about making contacts and eventually raising up a fleet? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors.
James Bullock was a Georgian. His family were old, you know, sort of Georgian family. He left himself quite young, you know, in his mid-teens, and joined the U.S. Navy. he had an unexciting career in the Navy, did very well for himself. He got promoted but eventually he resigns, I think in the 1840s or 1850s, because he essentially, he wants to make more money, and the promotion ladder in the U.S. Navy is incredibly slow. I mean, you can end up being a lieutenant for, 35 years or something in the old Navy. And so he joins a private steamship firm, and he spends his years going back and forth from Cuba and Florida up to New York and Washington, just bringing the mail and transferring passengers around. It's a very, it's a very comfortable existence. What he does pick up during all of these years is he knows how to, he works in shipyards, he commissions ships, he talks about the design and construction of ships, just because he's sort of dealing with shipyards and so on for his company. And this sort of stuff is a very valuable background. And it turns out, so when the war breaks out, Bullock is an odd fish in that he's very cunning and very clever. And he never really says what his views are, what his political views are. Remember, he was a Southerner. He's a Georgian Southerner. His father was his family was slave owners, for generations back. He himself, though, never owned slaves, and he left the South in his early teens. So he didn't have any property in the South or anything like that. So he's this Southern guy who's basically a Northerner. But at the beginning of the war, he kind of volunteers to come back for the nascent Confederate Navy, which I think at the time of the outbreak of war consisted of precisely one ship. So it wasn't a very impressive institution. But he gets picked up by Mallory, the new Secretary of the Navy, of the one ship Navy. And because Bullock is clean, as I said, he's not on any Union radar. He's been comfortably working for Northern firms for, a decade or two. He's got lots of friends there. He's not a slave owner. Nobody really knows much about him. But he's also an expert in ship construction, and he's very smart and charming and has a lot of international contacts. So he gets sent to Liverpool, and that's how it begins. And again, he's given a set of money, and his job is to commission the secret Confederate Navy.
The person that he squares off against, Thomas Dudley, tell me about him and also why he's such an interesting fit in Liverpool, which you wonderfully open the book with, describing Liverpool as sort of a combination of a war-torn third world country meets Las Vegas. So all the Dickensian nightmares you could possibly imagine are crammed into some very, very overflowing city blocks. So tell me about Thomas Dudley and the Liverpool that he arrives to square off against Bullock.
Thomas Dudley was born very humbly, unlike his rival Bullock, who was a kind of a Southern aristocrat. Though not a rich one, but Dudley, grew up as the son of a farmer in New Jersey. I think his father dies early. He and his siblings work on the farm for his mother. He puts himself through school, and he apprentices himself to a local lawyer and becomes a lawyer himself in New Jersey. He's a very strict and unbending Quaker. And along with that creed comes, a very, very determined attachment to abolitionism. I mean, no kidding around. Dudley puts principle into practice. I mean, he actually goes down south when this sort of stuff was very dangerous in the 1840s, early 50s, goes down south, disguises himself as a slave trader, or what he thinks is a slave trader outfit. And he, buys his slaves and brings them under the guise of sending them further south or farther south. And he brings them back across the northern line. I mean, this is a sort of dangerous occupation, and if he gets caught. And then he becomes a sort of a local grandee in Republican politics in New Jersey. And at the convention that brought Lincoln to the presidency, he does some deft wire pulling behind the scenes and helps bring the New Jersey delegation behind Lincoln. And, for that sort of thing, you get rewarded. There's always a bauble for that kind of sterling service. And Lincoln calls him over and says, you can be the minister or ambassador to Tokyo, or there's an opening as consul, which is a much lower diplomatic ranking, to Liverpool. And Dudley thinks about going to Tokyo, but eventually his health was not good after a near drowning sometime before, which really set him on his path. He decides that going to Tokyo would just be too far away from doctors. He didn't really know the area. It was a completely foreign country. So he decides to become consul to Liverpool in order to be, relatively close to good doctors. And he thinks that he's just going to be there for about a year, because that's the usual term of employment as a consul. And then he'd come back and get back to his legal practice. And what he ends up doing is unwittingly inheriting the most important intelligence posting in the entire world, because his arrival coincides a couple of months later after Bullock has been in Liverpool wreaking havoc and just hiring or just commissioning dozens and dozens of blockade runners who are, you know, causing chaos on Lincoln's blockade. So very quickly, Dudley, again, inadvertently, with no background in intelligence whatsoever, has to become an extraordinary agent. And it's up to him almost single-handedly to bring down and outfox and outfight Bullock. In the title, I call it, it's called The Lion and the Fox. And Dudley is the lion. You know, he never wavers. You know, he's very, very brave, very forthright about his abolitionism in a time when abolitionism, especially in Liverpool, was extremely unpopular. And everybody, all the merchants, all the industrialists, all, you know, all the shipyard people he dealt with were all, to a man, I mean, heavily pro-Confederate. And Bullock was running rings around him because he ruled the roost up there. But, you know, so he sticks there. Whereas Bullock has this kind of designedly aristocratic demeanor to him, you know, very charming, very amusing, you know, kind of waspish. Whereas Dudley has no discernible sense of humor whatsoever. You know, Bullock is the fox. He's going to outwit the lion, and he thinks he's got it all lined up. But then following the, I think it's from Petrarch or Machiavelli, I think, used it as well, about where the lion's, there's a saying about where the lion's skin will not fit, you patch it out with the fox's. And so the essential story of the book is that Dudley the lion slowly learns how to be a bit more of a fox. And in the end, yes, he beats Bullock and, well, outfoxes him, I guess you could say, while keeping to his principles. So it's an interesting conflict between these two characters.
Right. And aside, what you mentioned here with the interest in Liverpool with the Confederacy and the slave trade, I think something that's missed about this time period is slavery is understood in the 21st century completely in moral terms. And of course, it was a moral issue. But for the people at the time, it wasn't really a moral issue, but a financial issue. I mean, much in the way that somebody in Texas or an oil trader is very interested in Saudi Arabia, it doesn't mean that they sign off on their domestic policies and the morality police and preventing women from driving. Nobody would really sign up for that, but they're very interested in the oil and will very happily overlook all sorts of moral improprieties going on there for access to that kind of financial market.
Yeah, Bullock was very cagey, especially once he realizes that he's got to get around the British neutrality laws, which, you know, have, you know, significant punishments. If you get caught breaking those laws, or a shipbuilder gets caught breaking those laws, you know, the ship can be the assets and ship can be confiscated. And, you know, worst case scenario, you're looking at criminal charges, which would be, you know, extremely, you know, embarrassing and humiliating for anyone at the time. So what Bullock has to do is he has to set up a network, a shadow network of essentially front companies and cutouts and aliases and cover stories and all this sort of stuff. So in order to maintain, you know, sort of this hands-off approach that he has, that his name isn't attached to anything. He's not committing any crimes because it's all hidden. And he's got a lot of co-conspirators in Liverpool. There are many, many businessmen and industrialists, and especially the shipyard titans, who are all in favor of this. So they all go along with it. So Dudley, the Union consul, has, you know, he's facing this brick wall, this blank brick wall of silence and conspiracy. And he's the only, but occasionally he can break a brick in it and he can see through. But they're only isolated views and just isolated looks, glimpses of what's going on really behind the scenes. And as I explain in the book, he spends, after a while, he hits the files, you know, he puts together, you know, spends many, many months burning the midnight oil, you know, beetle-browedly studying newspaper reports, isolated notices and from his hired detectives who are watching the shipyards. He puts together receipts. He puts together, you know, just puts together all the paperwork. You know, like, in, you know, in those, you always see them in movies where there's a conspiracy and there's always all the pieces of paper and the newspaper articles on a wall with the red thread, you know, connecting them all. He essentially does that. Midway through the war, and using it, he breaks the wall with Bullock. And he comes up with, I think, something like 200 firms in Liverpool that he can prove are working or colluding with Bullock to break the law. It's quite an extraordinary intelligence coup. So this guy who was this Quaker lawyer who was supposed to just be the guy, a consul, and consuls, you know, traditionally just, you know, they help, they give money to drunk tourists who've lost all their money and can't get home, or they stamp passports and all that kind of stuff. You know, this guy is single-handedly, with some assistance, breaking down this vast Confederate network of businesses and individuals who are colluding with Bullock. So it's quite an extraordinary intelligence coup, one of the best around. We have it all on paper. It's really amazing how he did it.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors. It's interesting because in many ways, he seems like the wrong man for the job. That if you were going to hire a spy master, you wouldn't choose this incredibly straight-laced Quaker who you would assume that would never deign to get his hands dirty in the filth of Liverpool and remain in his consulate and only really go to church and speak with other dignified members of society. But he does the hard work. So does this say anything to you that, you know, sometimes people who are what we suppose are misplaced can rise to the challenge, or maybe there's a certain profile of a spy master that we don't identify. It is someone who will actually go and do his homework and, you know, read the ledgers and see how all the numbers add up and tabulate all the results. And this is an essential element. It's not the dashing charismatic person that will go up to the tavern and drink a tankard of mead and cozy up with the, you know, bosomy prostitute and get all the intelligence. Do we have spycraft wrong, or maybe people just rise to the challenge? What do you make of all this?
It's a great question. No, Dudley was a terrible choice for a spy master. I mean, just terrible. I mean, he's as you say, he's this very staid, steadfast, respectable Quaker. So yeah, who's again very naive. But over time, he learns to play the game, and you know, he hires people to hang around taverns and talk to and get drunk with sailors and get the information out of them. He learns how to hire those people and how to manipulate the information that ensues from that to leverage against Bullock. As I said, the lion becomes a bit more fox-like, which was critical to him. You know, so the fact is that he learned on the job, and it took him a while, and he made mistakes. But the fact is that Bullock made a bigger mistake, and that is that Bullock got too clever, and he underestimated his opponent, and eventually that opponent came back and took him down, along with all of his friends and networks and his entire apparatus of gun running and cotton smuggling and so forth. So yeah, I mean, it turns out that Dudley, you know, was the wrong man for the job, who turned out to be the right man for the job, and that another person, a different kind of person, would have given up much earlier than Dudley did, and would have fallen underneath all the slings and arrows that were being hurled at him. Because Dudley was a very unpopular person in Liverpool. I mean, he was really hated. I mean, I think within a few days of him getting there, he gets this delegation from, very pompous delegation from what are known as the American Chamber of Commerce. They weren't Americans, and what it was a club of Liverpool's most prominent merchants who dealt with America, American trade, and essentially the cotton traders. Very powerful and influential and rich men. And they come to him, they tell him about, they say, you know, you should lay off and know your place. We don't want any of that abolitionist talk here. And Dudley writes in his own memories of this, you know, he just summons himself up and he just counterblasts them. I mean, he just gives out a rousing defense of Lincoln and the Union and abolitionism. And all these guys go with their tails between their legs, realizing that this is not your usual consul. There's a kind of a new sheriff around who's going to be a real pain in the neck for them. And so it turns out to be. And in the end, he crushes them. You know, someone else would have kind of gone along to get along. And like other previous consuls, it was just a kind of a gentlemanly job that you did. I think Nathaniel Hawthorne, the great writer, was a consul to Liverpool in the 1850s. Basically, essentially, you just go along to some very pleasant dinners and get quite drunk and... And, you know, you get an award at the end, and that's about it. So these merchant kings and princes of Liverpool completely underestimated who they were dealing with. And I think that, you know, that's the important lesson here, is that the ones you least expect can be the most devastating, because they, again, as Dudley was, they are full of zeal and righteousness.
We always think of these people who can gather incredible intelligence are the partiers like a Richard Sorge in World War II who infiltrated the German embassy in Japan and stole critical state secrets for the Soviet Union. But there's a case to be made for people like Dudley. Well, I don't want to spoil a lot of the details of how he eventually cracks this. Listeners can check out your book, but I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying that the Union eventually won the Civil War. At least I hope I'm not. Otherwise, I haven't been doing a great job as a host. But because the Union did win, what do you see as the wider implications of Dudley eventually blowing open this attempt by the Confederacy to raise up a navy?
The most important thing that Dudley did was to stop and frustrate and to slow down Bullock's attempts to build this navy. If Dudley hadn't been there, there would have been many, many more very dangerous ships afloat. And, you know, if those rams, the ironclads, had gotten out of Liverpool, if Dudley hadn't managed to stop them at, you know, last minute, without giving away too many spoilers, you know, these things were capable of devastating the U.S. Navy. Same with if he'd managed to build more commerce raiders, like the Alabama and Florida. These things could have, you know, exerted a massive influence on the American economy and so on. So, you know, so Dudley is a very important figure strategically in stopping Bullock. I think on the grand strategic view, the attempt to build a Confederate Navy, it wouldn't have won the war for the South. It's not some sort of wonder weapon. What it would have done is, had it really come off, it would have, you know, really put the brakes on the Union economy. And more importantly, it would have aided the Southern economy, the war economy and its war footing immeasurably, and allowed it to continue to fight, you know, much longer than it actually did. And on a diplomatic level, the idea behind building this navy was to show the British, and to a lesser extent the French, but let's just focus on the British, that the South was a going concern, that they were going to be long-term winners. They own all the cotton, and, you know, the Royal Navy and the British government should come in and support them. And at the very least, sort of try and intervene, like almost like a UN blue helmet type peacekeeper force of some kind, which was seriously discussed at some points, until the British realized that, I can't remember who it was, might have been Russell, someone like that, basically saying that there's no point talking to these people, that they're all like mad dogs tearing each other's throats, that you can't talk sense into them. They don't want to have peace. This is sort of in 1862, 1863. The South, in order to win the Civil War, just doesn't have to lose. It just has to try and force an armistice or to tire out and bore the North. And maybe if they're lucky, they get, you know, Lincoln gets thrown out of power or something like that, and a good sort of peace-minded Democrat comes to power of some kind. So that's what they're really gambling at. They're not really looking at, especially after the first wave of attacks kind of peters out in the early stages of the war, they're not really looking to inflicting, you know, some sort of catastrophic 1945-style defeat of the Union. It's not going to happen. But what they want is just to get enough British support, keep their own economy humming along until the North gets tired and kind of says, okay, let's talk terms. And what that peace, that subsequent peace or armistice would have looked like is, you know, a matter of conjecture. My own view is it would have been something like, you know, Southern autonomy permitted to continue having slavery there, but with the understanding that it would eventually die out in the next generation or so. Something like that anyway. But because the Navy effort failed, and most importantly, the Navy effort failed without managing to lure the British in to an Anglo-Confederate Union, then, you know, it didn't work out that way, and it ended in complete and utter disaster. But some of that was, you know, much naval part was, you know, much of it was due to Dudley standing firm and just breaking Bullock's efforts to build this secret navy.
Well, from my research on the Civil War, some would say that it was never really a contest, but others, like you described, and I think I would mostly agree with, is that it was close in the sense that the South merely had to fight a successful war of attrition and tire out the North and perhaps get Lincoln to lose the 1864 election. And having British support, or at least a vibrant trade relationship with different cotton traders could have very well extended that. So this opens all sorts of different implications. And it really shows that these people that we don't think about very much had an unseen role in making something successful like the Civil War come about. Well, for listeners who do want to get into all the details and the subterfuge and, you know, the things that make the story fun, the name of Alex's book is The Lion and the Fox, Two Rival Spies and the Secret Plot to Build a Confederate Navy. And I understand you also have a Substack as well, where you get into all sorts of spycraft across history. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. It's on Substack. It's called Spionage. And, you know, every couple of weeks, you know, I talk about a different, you know, case of historical espionage. I mean, one week it can be spying in the 16th century Mediterranean. The next one, it's a World War I effort to kidnap the Kaiser, Germany. I think the coming week is about Revolutionary War spy, or was he? So it's just a little free newsletter you can sign up for, and it's called Spionage.
All right. Well, I recommend listeners check that out. And you can also check out The Lion and the Fox to hear more about this story. Alex, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Thank you.
All right. That is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.